Welcome to the July Citizens Climate Lobby call. If you are new to this call, we've been following the same format for the last 79 months, which is in just a couple of minutes I'll be introducing our guest speaker, and that will take up the first about half to two-thirds of the call. But then we'll do a report on what's happened since last month's call, and oh, by the way, 906 people just came back from Capitol Hill, where we saw over 500 people in the House and Senate, and so I suspect we will include a little bit of that on our reporting. And then the most important thing we always do is focus on what we're going to do this month. So we'll go over this month's actions and then tell you what we're asking everybody to do between now and the August call. Again, if you are brand new, welcome. My name is Mark Reynolds, and I'll be hosting today's call. Our guest is Patrick Carolyn from the Franciscan Action Network. This is the second call we've done in the last several months about the Pope's encyclical end visit. And I think that there is such a huge opportunity for us, not just in what the Pope wrote, but in the presentation he's going to be making to Congress in September. And it looks like Speaker Boehner is really doing a lot to make sure that that speech can get out to as many people as possible live, which I think is just thrilling, and I love that that's what the speaker's doing. Now, before I bring Patrick onto the call, Patrick, I just want to tell you a little bit about the people that you are speaking with. So, first of all, these are the most committed, prepared people that I have ever worked with. And, you know, the way they talk about what they're doing always expresses themselves better than me saying something about them. So I'm going to read a note to you, to everybody, that I got last week. During the conference, we gave Rabbi Judy Weiss a pen. And we gave her a pen because during the last 3 years, she has published 400 letters to the editor. Now, that's not writing and submitting 400. You have to have written and submitted a lot more to have 400 published. They were always thoughtful. They always responded to what the newspaper was reporting as news, and they were oftentimes funny. So we gave her a pen to just say what an extraordinary achievement that was. And here's the note she wrote back. She said, "Thank you for giving me a pen to mark the 400th published letter in 3 years. For a long time, there was a tradition that when a Jewish boy reached the age of 13 and celebrated his bar mitzvah, he received a pen. A pen was the standard, and usually the only one bar mitzvah gift a boy received. Why a pen? Bar mitzvah symbolizes becoming an adult. How can you work in your family's small business, acquire property, make a vow, study, marry, participate in community decision-making, or play a role in civic affairs without a pen? A pen symbolizes being a responsible adult. It was such a well-known, accepted tradition that Jewish playwrights and storytellers would allude to the bar mitzvah boy's pen. Humorists referred to a boy who received so many pens that he began his bar mitzvah speech with, 'Today I'm a fountain pen,' instead of, 'Today I'm a man.' When I was a kid, many segments of the Jewish community did not have bat mitzvah ceremonies, so I never received the pen. In May of 1968, when I was 13, I remember taking a school pen and signing my name to a registration sheet offering to volunteer to canvass house to house for Bobby Kennedy. 3 weeks later, he was assassinated. For me, his death capped a terrible series of political assassinations of people who were trying to do good and were cut down in their prime. After his death, I would have nothing to do with American politics. Thank you for giving me a way to participate in our political process again. For me, this pen echoes that school pen and the pen of responsible adult hold. I intend to pass it on to my grandson on the occasion of his bar mitzvah in 11 and a half years. With gratitude as we proceed as forces of nature with pens in hand instead of feverish, selfish little clods." In the last line, she refers to the George Bernard Shaw quote that Marshall referenced in his talk at the conference this year. So, Patrick, one thing I just wanted to tell you about the people you're speaking with today, not only are they incredibly committed and incredibly prepared, they're the kind of people who, when you give them something, they give you back something better than what you gave. They're just extraordinary people. So, Patrick, first of all, if you could tell us a little bit about the Franciscan Action Network, you know, what is the organization about, and then tell us some of the work that you've been doing in relationship to the encyclical, some of the things that you'll be doing in relationship to his presentation to Congress, and some of the guidance you can give us about how we can best leverage this activity. There were a lot of questions that were sent to me in advance of the call, and hopefully we'll have time for some of them, but welcome and thank you so much for making yourself available today.
Well, thank you, and thank all of you for all of the hard work that you do. I'm in Connecticut. My office is in Washington, D.C., So I do get the opportunity to work with the Citizens Lobby folks, both in Connecticut and in D.C. from time to time. And so, Mark, I know what you're saying about how committed and dedicated the folks are. Before I share about my organization and myself, let me share also a story. Last week I was in I was in Rome for a week for a meeting. And the last 2 days of the meetings were at Pontifical Council on Justice and Peace, which is the council in the Vatican that really came out and pushed the encyclical. It's the council that Cardinal Turskin heads up. He was the keynote speaker at this meeting. It was 2 days of meetings of mostly Catholic, not all Catholic, but leaders from around the world, faith leaders from around the world, to talk about how we can really get the message out around the world on the encyclical. One of the people that was invited to speak at it was Naomi Klein, and I'm sure most of you know who she is or have read some of her stuff. She just wrote an article yesterday that was published yesterday in New Yorker called A Radical Feminist Jew at the Vatican. So one of the most exciting things about this encyclical is that it has, for Catholics, for us Catholics, it's brought on a new age. The fact that Naomi Klein is invited to the Vatican to speak, and I had the honor and pleasure of having dinner with her in Rome on Thursday evening, and she said to me that three different times she said to the Pontifical Council folks, "Are you sure you want me there to speak?" She kept asking them that question, and not only was she invited to speak and be on a panel, but she was invited to be at a press conference with several of the leading cardinals in the Vatican. And she said, "Are you sure that I'm the person you want?" And they said, "Absolutely. We want you to speak. We want you to be at this press conference." So it's a new age in the Vatican. This would never have happened 5 years ago, 4 years ago, for somebody like Naomi Klein. If you do get a chance, her article is the online version of the New Yorker. Take a look at it. It's a great article about her experience. And when they introduced her, she used that title because when Cardinal Turskin introduced her, that's how he introduced her, as a radical feminist Jew. And so they knew who she was, and they invited her. My organization, the Franciscan Action Network, I don't know what y'all know about Franciscans. Some of you probably know a lot, and some of you might know a little bit, and some of you probably are Franciscans. But we are a coalition in the United States, an organization that's made up of all of the different branches of the Franciscan family. Let me say there are a lot of, there's not one Franciscan order. There are a lot of different Franciscan orders. There's orders of men, there's Catholic and there's OFMs. There's about 70 different orders of women. There's an order of secular Franciscans. There's an order of Episcopalian Franciscans. There's an order of Lutheran Franciscans. There's an order of ecumenical Franciscans. And now there's a new order called the Fourth Order, which is all Franciscan-hearted people, which includes Hindus and Jews and Muslims who understand and love the teaching of Francis of Assisi. So the Franciscans were founded by Francis of Assisi and founded on the principle of being in relationship with all of creation, being part of all of creation. My order was started, my organization was started 8 years ago at a gathering in Baltimore of about 160 Franciscan leaders from around the country who said, "We're all working on social justice issues by ourselves, but we should all be working on this together as a Franciscan family." But I've created the Franciscan Action Network. I've been their executive director for 5 years now. And we work primarily in the United States, although that has expanded in the last year, but primarily in the United States on issues of social justice, which include immigration reform, climate change, climate crises, human trafficking, gun safety. Most recently, we started a whole project on money and politics from a faith perspective. We work in coalition with a lot of other faith communities and faith organizations, as well as secular NGOs and a group like the Citizens Climate Lobby. And we are also one of the organizations that helped start most recently this past January the Global Catholic Climate Movement, which started in January and since January at the Worldwide Movement of Catholic Organizations. Since January, we've grown to over 100 partner organizations. We've had a number of projects, including a climate fast, hunger fast in Lent, where we had Catholics from a different country going on a hunger fast each day during Lent. It's part of the overall climate fast movement. We ended up with 60 countries and over 10,000 Catholics around the world going on a hunger fast. So our work in the area of climate change, really part of it is to raise awareness on climate change as a moral issue, to bring in, you know, I often tell people that as Franciscans, we've been at this for about 800 years. This is not a new issue for us. We've been at it 800 years, not me personally, of course, but for Franciscans have been since the time of St. Francis. And so you're welcome to our party because we've been doing this for a long time. There's a lot of stories about Francis of Assisi. One of the stories that you often hear is how he would go out and talk to the animals. He would talk to the birds or talk to the trees, and people would say to him and ask him, why would you do that? Why would you go out and talk to the animals? And his response was very simple. He said, God told me to preach the gospel to my brothers and sisters, and the birds and the trees and all of creation is my brother and sister. So for Francis, it was not an issue of dominion over. It was an issue of being in relationship with all of creation. And Franciscans really look at all of creation that way. There's a great story of there's a university up in outside of Detroit, Madonna University, the Franciscan University, and they had to build a nursing school, a new nursing school. In order to build this new nursing school, it involved cutting down trees, and they really struggled with should they cut these trees down. And they finally made the decision that what they would do is they would cut the trees down and use the wood from these trees to build the chapel and the nursing school. So rather than just cut the trees down and throw the wood away, they used it for to build the chapel, build the pews in the chapel. So if you go to Madonna University, go sit in the chapel, you'll be sitting on wood that came from trees that were on that ground. That's how Franciscans view all of creation. So my organization is partners with a number of other organizations, including Green Faith. We work very closely. Fletcher and I work very closely together. Both of us helped start the Our Voices campaign, which is another worldwide movement, which just recently had a very successful rally in Rome, where something about around 5,000 people marched to the Vatican to say thank you, Pope Francis. Pope Francis came out on the balcony of the Vatican and waved and thanked the marchers for coming. We work on that. We're working most recently, obviously, on the encyclical. The meetings I've been at in Rome have all been about how do we get the message of the encyclical out there. And, you know, I know you've done some workshops or had some speakers before that have talked about what is an encyclical, so I won't spend any time on that. But this is a most extraordinary encyclical. Both encyclicals are written. They're sent out to bishops. A couple of bishops might actually read them. And then they're put on bookshelves, and then theologians in universities and seminaries pull them out every once in a while, and the debate over the meaning of one or two words. There's never been an encyclical written like this that has such a build-up to it. And that's not an accident. That was done on purpose. There was a whole plan of action on how to have this encyclical have its most powerful impact. One of the things that's happened because of the encyclical and before the encyclical is that it has brought together the faith community, the environmental community, labor, and a number of other organizations have really started working together to build a movement around social change. I was at a meeting in Washington, D.C. yesterday. I think Rhett from my staff might be on the call, but Rhett was at that meeting also. It was with some of the top people at the AFL-CIO, one of the top people at the World Wildlife Fund, and folks from other organizations really talking about how we could all work together and how we can collaborate on this issue, because this it's such an important time, such an important moment. And so we shouldn't be afraid, even if, you know, people who aren't Catholic, people who are atheists, don't believe in God, shouldn't be afraid to take the encyclical, read it carefully, it's a simple read. It's one of the beauties of this particular encyclical is people like myself can actually understand it. You don't need to have a degree in theology to understand it. And it's written in such beautiful language of inclusiveness, interconnectedness, instead of separation, living in a world of interconnectedness. Read it. Translate it into your own spiritual tradition, whatever that happens to be, and use that as a message for people, your friends, your family. Use it if you're part of a faith community. Go to your priest, your minister, your rabbi, and ask them, why aren't you talking about this? You know, one of the things that happened with this encyclical was 200 rabbis in the United States came out and issued a statement and got together and issued a statement supporting the encyclical and saying this is how what the encyclical says and this is how it's interpreted in the Jewish tradition. Muslim leaders have come out. You know, every faith, I can go through a whole list of faith leaders that have come out in supporting this encyclical. When Pope Francis released the encyclical, the patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church was the person who was at the press conference to release the encyclical. So it is it's written to all people. Most encyclicals are written to his brother bishop. This encyclical is written to all people. And it talks about our common home. And so that's the message that we have to get out there, that this is our common home. This is our only home. And if we destroy this, we destroy our home. I'll also just share a little bit about, again, what's happening, going to happen over the next couple of months, or what we hope to happen. Part of our meeting yesterday was that we're organizing events in Washington, D.C. around the Pope's vision. And you know, we thank John Boehner for at least doing something. But he is, they are having big screens out on the Mall. So we're going to organize over probably by Lincoln Memorial some type of an event, prayer vigil, rally, before, and then have people walk over to the other part of the Mall to watch Pope Francis's giving his talk to Congress. I do want to say his talk to Congress will not just be about the climate crisis. It'll be about poverty. It'll be about income inequity. It'll be about immigration. So that particular talk will be about a number of issues, which is why we're trying to bring a lot of people of different organizations and different causes together. His talk the next day at the United Nations will be probably just about climate change, although he'll bring in some of these other issues into it and as part of it. So keep that in mind for September. After he leaves the United States, he's going to Africa, and we're working with some of our friends and allies in Africa, Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania and countries like that, where they're starting to organize events for when the Pope comes there. He's right now down in South America. So there's going to be a whole series. Again, these are all very well planned and orchestrated so that to get the message out of that we have to care for this home. This is our only home. So I think I spoke long enough, and I'll answer questions that people might want to have.
Great. Okay, well, thank you for that. That was lovely. I really appreciate that. So we got a lot of questions. I'm going to try and get through as many of them as we can. The first one was, how do you recommend we approach the U.S. Catholic bishops on particularly working with us on a policy we're trying to enact? So is there some guidance you can give us about working with the U.S. Catholic bishops?
Let me say that we work very closely with the U.S. Conference of Bishops. Sometimes there's tension there, sometimes there's not. And I know Danny knows Dan Niesla very well at the Catholic Climate Covenant. He's certainly a person to work with. But I also, I mean, you have people in every diocese. Y'all should reach out to each of you, to your bishops, particularly Catholics, but not just Catholics. Organize, you know, if there's folks in your diocese, if you're in Madison, Wisconsin, for instance, and you can reach out to some of the Catholics there that are partners with you or you know are active in this, set up a meeting with the bishop and really ask them and say, why aren't we talking more about this? And can we do an event, an interfaith event here in the diocese where you can come and talk about this encyclical? So do it from that level. Doing it from the top down is never going to work. But you guys are a grassroots organization, so you have the opportunity to do it. And also, do it with the priests. The bishops sometimes will listen to the priests, and so go to the local Catholic priests find a parish in your area that's very strong on social justice and ask them about it.
Yeah, that's great. And one thing you've already addressed, I got a lot of questions about how to work with other faiths other than Catholics, and I think you've addressed that quite a bit already, so I think I'll skip that one.
Okay, yeah, let me just say on that, that so this encyclical was written for all faiths and all people, so don't be afraid to talk about the encyclical and invite Muslims or Jews into the conversation and do it that way.
Great. Okay, good. So, you know, who knew that this pope was kind of a policy wonk also? In Clause 171, he talks about carbon credits. And I'm hoping we can get some clarification on this. I think some people thought that might be kind of a, you know, something in the European Union trading emission system, and I don't think it is. I think, especially from reading Cardinal Turkson's work, I think it's more about the offset programs that take advantage of developing countries where they put at a huge disadvantage. Can you elaborate at all on what the Pope was trying to get at talking about against trading of carbon credits?
Well, you know, first of all, let me just say that Pope Francis doesn't normally call me up and talk to me about what he's thinking about. So I want to clarify that right away. I haven't met him. But
Thank you for that.
Yeah, so, which he would sometimes, but he doesn't. But, you know, in my reading of that, and some discussions I've had with people and listening to other people talk about it, there is a concern that carbon credits is just another way to allow first world countries to continue living the way they're living. And I know one of the things that Pope Francis is very strong on, and he's going to talk about this, is folks in the United States, folks in Canada, folks in the European countries, we really have to rethink our lifestyles if we're going to make a difference. And so I think there's a concern that carbon credits is this sort of, well, we can buy our way out of this kind of thing. And so, but again, that would be how I read that. And it's certainly how I, you know, I'm commenting on it through my vision also, and that's how, what I think of it too, is I'm not a big fan of carbon credits because I think it is just a way of allowing wealthy countries, wealthy corporations, wealthy people to buy their way out of change. Kind of like, you know, when in the Civil War, when you were, if you were wealthy, you could pay somebody to go fight for you.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Very nice. Okay. So, because one of our actions is going to be this month, we're going to ask people to go out and make talks, and that one of the places where we have them targeted is particularly in churches, other groups, but that is one of our targets for this month. So, for you, how do you explain to people the connection between your faith and the need for climate action?
Well, I look at it, again, as part of the Franciscan family, that we're all connected. I mean, Pope Francis has talked about feeling and the suffering of the loss of a species and literally feeling that suffering, that pain. This is something that St. Francis of Assisi felt and St. Hildegard and other mystics and not just from the Catholic tradition, but from the Muslim tradition, people like Rumi, they felt that deep suffering of the loss of life. And so, It's for me, it's about being in relationship with all of creation and with everything that is created. And all of creation expresses God's love, just as God's love is expressed in all of creation. So if all of creation is expressing God, then how can we not care for it? How can we not be in relationship? Just as we would any of our brothers and sisters, as we should any of our brothers and sisters.
Great. And I got a lot of questions also in the area of, you know, so we work very intensely with Congress. I mean, last year we had over 1,000 visits. We had over 500 mm-hmm. visits in June alone. Members of Congress are going to be back in the district in August, which is going to be give us plenty of time to meet with them during that recess. Obviously, we'll be very focused on the Pope's visit in September. What are your recommendation about what we do and also what we don't do? I mean, I don't think beating people over the head with something and saying, "Hey, see, the Pope told you so," is going to work. But
well, you know, that's a good point, although I often remind people that St. Francis at one point in his life was very upset over what the, not only the church, but the political leaders were doing, and so he got naked in the public square. And I was in a meeting in Washington, D.C. a couple years ago, and a whole group of faith people, and we're a little bit frustrated over the budget, and a friend of mine is a Baptist preacher, got up and he said, we should do what St. Francis did. We should get naked in the public square and we should tell them all they're going to go to hell. Now, I'm not recommending you go to a congressional office and get naked because that probably won't help our cause out much. But I think a couple of things, and one thing, and you know, we'd love to work with you on this, is we're looking at the possibility of focusing on and identifying 2025 Catholic Republican members of Congress who are climate deniers or on the, you know, not necessarily deniers, but even the ones who are deniers, really going and getting local people, sisters and priests, to organize meetings or an event in their district and asking them, this is what the Pope says. What is your position on it? Asking them in a nice way, but asking them in a way that will make them feel uncomfortable. You know, I often tell people that we're not going to solve this issue through passing legislation. We're only going to do it through transformation. And people never transform in their comfort zone. You have to make people feel uncomfortable before they'll transform. So I wouldn't hesitate to make them feel uncomfortable. This is too important of an issue to all sit around and hold hands and sing kumbaya about. We have to go out and, you know, we can do it in a nice way, but we have to do it in a way that's powerful enough to make them feel uncomfortable. And if they see a coalition of Catholics and Jews and Protestants and, you know, non-faith community groups and NGOs coming together and going and saying to them, we think this is important. Here's what the Pope says. Where do you stand on this? Are you with the Pope? We started a whole campaign and created a hashtag, Pope versus Coke. And we asked people, are you with the Pope or are you with the Coke brothers? And it's real simple. I wouldn't hesitate to do that. And again, we'd be happy to work with you on some of that as well and identify 20 or 25 folks where you have members in and we can organize some of the Catholic communities there and, organize some events around that. You know, you don't need to swing everybody. You need to get about 10 or 15 deniers to come over and say, I see the light. You know, as we like to call it, they have their come to Jesus moment. I think it's the Baptists that say that, but.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm a big fan of that phrase, though. You know, it's really interesting on the science issue. We saw a little over 500 offices in June. We saw 120 in November that was very much targeted in committees that we would need to work with to get legislation passed. So that was Ways and Means in the House and Senate Finance. We are getting almost no pushback anymore on the science, which is a big change over the last few years. And I think it's because we've been focused so much on solutions that could be palatable to both sides of the aisle. So we had under 7% of the offices we met with, and this is after meeting almost the entire conference, that raised any issue on the science. So I think that people are getting more interested in solutions rather than an argument about whether the science is there or not.
Well, and here's the thing to be cautious on. This is the new argument that the Heartland Institute has come out with, and so you should be prepared for this. They've come out with statements, and I've heard it now from bishops and conservative bishops and priests and other religious leaders, and it's what's called energy poverty. And they talk about how we're not really supporting lifting people out of poverty because the best way to lift people out of poverty is to provide energy. And so by providing coal and oil, coal-fired plants, we're helping lift the poor out of poverty. By opposing that, we're working to keep people in poverty. It's an interesting argument. It's a well-thought-out argument. And I actually have, you know, we've written some statements on that, Mark, I'm happy to send over to you so you can pass them out to your group and use them as you see fit. But that will be an argument that people will use against you now.
Yes, I expect people who want to maintain the status quo will continue to invest some really clever people at trying to make, you know, more and more elaborate arguments, and I expect that, and I think we simply need to be responsible that we need to be able to deal with that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, thank you so much. We really, really appreciate yourself making yourself valuable. This was fantastic. We will obviously stay in close touch with you between now and September to see how we can collaborate, and you're certainly welcome.
I was going to say one other thing that, you know, we'd be interested in working with you on, and this is part of our global capital climate movement. We started a petition drive, and we actually got Pope Francis to endorse the petition. We have a picture of him with our petition. We got Cardinal Paglia from the Philippines to sign the petition. And so our goal initially was to get 1 million signatures on this petition. We've been told by the folks in the Philippines that they themselves are going to get over 5 million signatures. We've been told by people in Brazil, Catholic leaders and Franciscan leaders in Brazil, that they're going to get 5 million signatures on this petition. In the United States, it looks like maybe we'll get 150 signatures on this petition. And so if you go to the Global Catholic Climate Movement website, you can download the petition. You can take it and, have people sign it and scan it and send it back to us. We'll download it and put the signatures on. We're not carding anybody, so you don't actually have to have a card proving you're a Catholic to sign it. I think it'll be very sad if we get 5 million from Brazil, 5 million from the Philippines, you know, 1 million from Australia, all these other countries, and we get, you know, 20,000 from the United States. So we really want to make a big push to see if we can at least get 500,000, 1 million signatures in the United States on this petition.
Okay, great. Fantastic.
So if you guys can help us with that.
Yeah, no, that would be embarrassing to get 5 million from the Philippines, 20,000 here, so.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people will go download that. Thank you so much for letting us know that that's there.
Yeah.
And again,
thank you.
You're welcome to stay for the 10 minutes if you like, but if it's, you know, I know Saturday and you have to drop off.
It's Saturday, so yeah, I am going to hop off. But again, thank you all for everything you do. It does take a movement to bring about change, and we're all part of this movement, so I'm grateful to be with you and talk to you today.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Okay, we're going to get a report on what happened since last month's call in just a moment, and then we'll talk about what we're going to do in the U.S. and Canada. I'm going to ask Alex Amonette from Tri-Cities Washington to report on how she transitioned her meeting with her member of Congress and what she's going to do following that, because it lines up with everything we want to do this month. So, first of all, Alex, have you been able to unmute your phone so we can hear your report?
Yes, hi.
Good. I can hear you loud and clear. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first, I appreciate all the excellent lobbying training. I felt really well prepared and able to think on my feet. And one of the supporting asks was, can you introduce us to people in your district who have influence with conservatives? So for background, I just want to say my Republican congressman is a very warm, statesmanlike man, and he's a successful farmer. He barely won his election against a Tea Party challenger who's also a farmer, and it's his first term. So we really need to build political will in our district, which produces major export crops. We have no snowpack, and the extreme heat, hail, drought, and fires have reduced crop yields. So I'd already set up a meeting with a man I'll call Bob, from another agricultural commodity group at the end of July before I left to lobby in D.C. And that meeting includes a hydrologist, soil scientist, and myself. And also, Kelly Lively from Michigan CCL and I are writing an article about the climate change impacts on a commodity that our two states have in common and the fee and dividend solution. And we pitched it to a major commodity magazine. So during my lobbying meeting, I briefed my congressman about the several ag groups with whom our chapter has already discussed the fee and dividend. And I asked him with whom else he thought I should talk in our district to build political will. And he named one grower organization and also specifically a man I'll call Joe, who's the head of a major fruit commodity group. I'd been playing phone tag with Joe and had attended one of his group's meetings in May where they'd predicted huge crop yields. But when I got back home, I called Joe and said, I've just returned from discussing the fee and dividend with our congressman who suggested I talk with him. And Joe said, he's really a marketer and legislation is outside his scope. Well, I said, well, in preparation for writing this article about the crop he markets, I'd interviewed two well-respected agricultural scientists that he knows about the extreme weather variability lately. And I said, I've got an informal meeting set up at the end of the month with Bob, whose office happens to be in the same building as Joe's, and it's an 80-mile drive for us. And evidently, the fact that my congressman suggested I talk with him and my contact with scientists that he held in high repute sunk in, and his tone really changed. Joe said, you know, I've never, ever seen what we're experiencing. And then he anxiously reads one of the ag scientists' emails each Friday afternoon to get a read on the weather. So he offered to set up the conference room for the meeting with Bob and us, and he invited, suggested inviting the editor of the magazine for whom Kelly and I are writing the article. So our meeting's all set. That's it.
Well, so Alex, I just want to make sure I'm tracking this. So one of the things that happened is you met with your member of Congress. He said, go get this person's support. You called that person and said, hey, our member of Congress said I should meet with you. And then to make it easy, in addition to you coming in to talk to him, you said, here's these other scientists that are important to you. I'll bring them along to make it easier for him to accommodate the meeting.
Yeah, it's actually two different scientists that we have set up for the meeting.
Yeah.
They mentioned these other additional two scientists that I actually have interviewed in preparation for this article, and he knows them quite well and respects them very highly.
Fantastic. Great work. Congratulations. I can't wait to hear how it goes.
Yeah, I'll let you know.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. All right. So let's just talk a little bit about what happened in D.C. a couple of weeks ago. So in preparation, there was over 500 bios prepared, 200 meeting plans written by liaisons, 1,700 previous meeting notes pushed out. We all got our schedules in advance this year. And what that enabled us to do is that in most cases, we had a lot more time to sit down and plan the actual meeting. So I think that that across the board should elevate the quality of meetings because we all had additional preparation time. We ended up with 906 people in Washington, D.C. Around 800 of those ended up lobbying. We had over 500 meetings between the House and Senate. And again, as I mentioned with our speaker a few minutes ago, we had almost no pushback again. So now this is a November day, lobby day last November with 120 offices, now 500 offices of the House and Senate, and less than 7% of those meetings reflected any pushback on the science. I do think our focus on staying on solution, on solution, on solution is making a big difference over time. I also want to thank all the groups that have gotten the op-ed that I wrote addressing that 2 weeks ago. That's been published in 26 papers now. The one that's titled Everything You Know About Republicans and Climate Change is Wrong. So thank you all who've been out there pitching that. I think there's still some other papers that could pick it up. What are we going to have available after the conference? Well, a good deal of the conference was filmed, and so very shortly we'll have Catherine Hayhoe's video and her PowerPoint out to you. Bob Perkowitz's from EcoAmerica on Sunday night, the Marshall's introductory remarks, the expert panel, which was Jim Hansen, Shiling Su, and Ann Kelly, the hysterical game show that Ellie invented called The Carbon Price is Right, and five breakout sessions. So all of those will be available, and you'll have them as resources and tools. I think in some cases it will be nice just to be able to refresh some of the talks that people gave us, and in some cases it will be great to be able to get that out to other people. Next year, we're going to be going back to the same hotel on the same weekend. So I think the conference starts on the 19th of June, but it's essentially the same weekend it was. That room that we were in can hold up to 2,000 people. So we'll figure out how many people can come to the conference and what percentage of those will actually be able to lobby. You know, again, there were a bunch of people who registered late this year, and they came and they were part of the conference, but they didn't actually go to Capitol Hill with us, and that's fine. Part of that included just other NGOs in Washington, D.C. that wanted to attend the conference. You know, Catherine Hayhoe has had a lot of work with this organization, and one of the things she said in her talk was that she doesn't ever meet with a member of Congress unless there's a CCLer with her. So we booked her for this conference a year ago, and she's spoken at some of our regional conferences. Some of you have seen her speak live. And I kept reminding her during the course of the year, you know, we have a lot of contact with you. You got to save something special for us. And she said she would, and she did. And, you know, after listening to her talk, it made me think of Les Miserables. You know, some of you saw that. Some of you saw the movie. Maybe some of you have seen the musical. I had the pleasure of reading the book. And my only regret in reading the book was that I didn't get a chance to read it in French because I thought the prose was phenomenal. And the first 100 pages of Les Miserables is really about the priest and establishing a moral basis for the whole 1,000-page book. And there's a scene early on where he goes out in the courtyard and he stares up at the stars and he says, he was not impressed by God, he was dazzled by him. And that's what I told Catherine Hayhoe, that she dazzled us. And I'm really happy that we'll have all of that out to you shortly. Okay. So what do we do? Oh, excuse me. Hold on. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Amy Bennett, are you there?
Yes, I am.
We didn't only do the conference. People did other stuff, right?
Yes, they did.
Okay. What did I miss?
Well, overall, let me give you a few points that are real interesting. Last year, we added 80 CCL chapters. Now, this year, we've added 50, and it's only halfway through the year. So we are on pace to, you know, do way more than last year. We're also averaging over 200 letters to the editor each month. Additionally, last year we had 291 op-eds for the entire year, and this year, so far, we've got 241. So, again, halfway through the year, we are on course to bust through that record as well. And if you were at last year's conference, I think you probably will remember Lynnae Pettengill said that we're up to 5,000 supporters. And this year, at the end of the month, we were at 17,191. Another world record, Mark.
Well, okay. So in addition to the conference, people were still busy. A whole bunch of stuff happening. That's fantastic. Thank you, Amy.
Sure.
Okay, great. All right, so what are we going to be doing this month? So, again, remember that in addition to the actions we're going to go over, members of Congress are going to be in district the whole month of August. And are you allowed to do things that are not on the action sheet? Yes. Just because it doesn't say go get a meeting for August on the action sheet doesn't mean you aren't encouraged to do it. That would be great, and they'll be doing some public events also. But specifically what we're recommending is that people get endorsements from community leaders for climate action and CCL's policy. We have two different ways that can be done, just a general statement of support or specifically supporting fee and dividend. We would also like you to schedule and conduct outreach presentations with church and other groups, and there's all kinds of supporting material for both those actions attached to the action sheet with links. In Canada, we're asking you to write a letter to your premier regarding carbon pricing individually or as a group. Use your premier letter and this month's Laser Talk to help you write letters to the editor and op-eds. So great month this last month. Let's stay busy this month. The August call is going to be 100% dedicated to how do we get the most out of every single letter. So when we get a letter published, or we get an op-ed published, or we get a chance to make a presentation somewhere, how do we maximize its impact? How do we use it to create the most possible political will we can? All right, I'm going to unmute the phone so everybody can say goodbye.
All guests have been unmuted.
Yeah.